Hello, and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talked to a Brock graduate from 1979 who was back at his alma mater last week to receive the 2013 Distinguished Mathematics and Science Alumni Award. We hear from a Brock instructor and cultural historian who has more than a passing interest in the Beatles and being a university town. We talk about the relationship between a university and a municipality, with the author of a new book on the subject. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. We welcome you to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. Recently on the program, we talked with Brock geography professor Michael Pisarek about the leaching of drilling wastes produced by oil and gas exploration activities in the 70s and 80s up in the Mackenzie Delta region. The drilling wastes were stored in the permafrost, and with global warming, they are now affecting water quality and aquatic organisms in some of the lakes of the Arctic. One of the co-authors of some of Pisarek's research papers was in Niagara last week, the recipient of the 2013 Distinguished Mathematics and Science Alumni Award. That came from Brock University. And he gave a lecture last Wednesday evening on some of the research he's been doing. Dr. John Small, a Brock Master of Science graduate in biology from 1979, is now Canada Research Chair, Environmental Change at Queen's University. His lecture last week was entitled, "The Past Matters, Studying the Effects of Human Impacts on Aquatic Ecosystems Using Lake Sediments." I talked to Dr. Small on the weekend by phone from his office at Queen's, and I asked first how his homecoming went at Brock last week, and the fact, probably to him, things have changed more than a little over the years.
Well, that's entirely true. I was at Brock as a master's student, and I was there just under 2 years, between 1977 and 1979, and it was a very, very different place then. I think the way we refer to it euphemistically, we were called it Glenridge Campus, and that was basically an abandoned refrigerator factory at the bottom of the hill there. So you literally were separated from the main campus. Of course, the main campus was just a fraction of what it is now, but at least the tower was there and a few of the other buildings. But the so-called Glenridge campus was an abandoned refrigerator factory where we sort of had some offices and some labs and a few trailers in the back for extra space. I recall also an occasional rodent problem going on down there. But you were almost like a penal colony down there. You'd look up and you see the tower. And the only way you got to the main campus, you either hitched a ride or you took the bus. You had a free bus transport up the hill. Or we eventually had pathways. We'd walk up the escarpment and so on and so forth. But it really was a very different place. Brock was much, much smaller and really has changed remarkably over the 30 years.
What was the thing that struck you most when you got back to Brock last week, when you approached the campus? What was the first thing you thought?
Well, the size of the campus, first of all. I mean, Brock, when I was there, was just a small place. You know, it really was a few thousand students and a few buildings, sort of in sort of the corner of St. Catharines. One was the size of the physical structure of the university, the buildings, the modernity of the buildings. The second was the number of people. I mean, it really was a very small place. It was just like a little sort of, almost like a little college out on the outskirts of St. Catharines. And now, I mean, you know, it's a medium-sized university. It's, well, I'm at Queen's University. I think we have about the same number of students. So, you know, it's not, it's no longer a small place. So those are the two things that really hit me.
I had a chat with a Brock professor a couple of months ago who really drove the point home about the size of Brock, because she said, you know, we're about, with faculty and staff and students, about 20,000. We're the size of a small town right within the city.
That's true, yes. Yeah.
And I thought of that, and I thought, my goodness, you know, like, that gives you an idea of just how big Brock has become over the years.
How big and how important it is. I mean, it's important, obviously, for education and furthering people's lives and stuff, but it's also important to the community. Sometimes the communities forget, you know, think of universities, oh, that's where all the noise might come from or something, but economically, universities are incredibly important for a community. They obviously enrich rigid with academic and cultural and bringing in events and bringing in lecturers and bringing in entertainment and stuff like that. But also economically, those students bring in money. They rent houses, they rent apartments, they buy groceries. I know that. I'm in a university town myself in Kingston, Ontario. If the university left, I think Kingston would be quite in big problems. So I don't think they're going to leave, but they're very important in many aspects to a community.
I want to talk now about some of the research you've been doing. And I talked last month on the program to Brock Associate Professor Michael Pasarek about the work he's been doing researching the effects of leaching of drilling wastes in the Mackenzie Delta. He didn't paint a very pretty picture of the problem up there. Can the environmental damage done by civilization over the years be reversed, do you think, or are we literally stuck with a now damaged ecosystem?
Yeah, well, it depends on the problem. Some problems have some reversibility, some don't. For example, extinction. Extinction's forever. If you kill off a species, it's not coming back. With some types of pollution, it's very, very hard to come back. Sometimes there's a little bit more positive. I'll use acid rain as an example. I cut my teeth on acid rain when I got here to Queens about 25 or so years ago, and we got some very good legislation on acid rain. Now, acid rain is still happening, but it certainly didn't happen what could have happened, and we caught it just in time. So there are examples of recovery. Another one is lake eutrophication, or the over-fertilization of lakes. That was a major issue. That was a little before my time, in the 1970s, let's say. We caught most of that in time, and we do see some very nice recoveries on those issues. Now, other issues, it's much longer, or it's very hard to recover from. And some are very complex issues, like climate change, and so on and so forth. So we're increasing the complexity of a lot of our problems.
I remember years ago, acid rain was what everyone was talking about. Now, more people are talking about climate change. Are the two intertwined?
They're not totally intertwined. There are connections between the two. The most similarities, well, one was a chemical issue of, you know, chemical transport of acid through the atmosphere. Climate change is that we're kind of changing the physics and chemistry of our atmosphere and warming up the planet. They were both very serious issues, but in many respects, I think in some ways acid rain was practice for some of us. We thought acid rain was a very complex issue. We were working on it. In reality, it was relatively simple compared to climate change. There are those similarities in how dealing with it in the public sector and with politicians. There was a very organized campaign against getting legislation for acid rain legislation, coming especially from industries that were causing acid rain. And we have the similar type of thing happening with climate change. Big producers of greenhouse gases seem intent on, confusing the issue. I think it's the most polite word I can say. There was the same things happening with acid rain, and there was this idea of making, you know, all the same arguments. First, it was all natural. Well, then that was no longer tenable. Well, that's what we hear with a very small but very loud portion of the climate change community. And we have the same types of things now. And I think that's a bit worrisome. Sometimes we didn't learn any lessons, and we're still doing the same type of thing.
Yeah, I posed the question to Professor Pasarek about climate change, whether that's the proverbial elephant in the room that we have to deal with now. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's the big one, you know. And it's also, I call it the threat multiplier. It's quite striking how changes in climate, especially the way we are changing the climate, never mind the problems with climate, which is a whole issue on its own, but it's also what we call a threat multiplier. It's doing many, many other things. Many of the other problems get worse with climate change, so it really is a very wicked kind of problem.
How likely is society as a whole to be able to reverse the effects of climate change? Do we have the will to do that?
The will is the problem. You know, if we... Every time we keep adding more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, we're making a bigger problem. And people start saying the right things, like we have to do something, we should do something, we plan on doing something, but we're incredibly slow in actually doing anything. And the longer we wait, the harder it is. And the harder it is, the more it's going to cost. And people keep talking about the cost of doing something. Well, what's the cost of doing nothing or not doing enough? Somehow that's got to be incorporated into the formula, and we seem to be very poor at doing that.
Yeah, talk is cheap, and there's always opportunity to say we're going to do something about it.
Yeah.
Now, your talk last week had a good deal to do with your research, the pollution caused by Alberta oil sands production over the years. What essentially is going on with the Alberta oil sands that we should be concerned about?
Well, you know, I mean, like most environmental issues or economic issues, it has two sides. It has some pluses and it has some negatives. The pluses are quite clear in the oil sands. Big money, lots of money, jobs, and the usual things people worry about. But there are costs associated, and that's my concern. I'm not saying we have to stop, you know, we're obviously not going to stop using fossil fuels, but I think we should do it a little more carefully. And there's a lot of negatives coming from the oil sands that I think we haven't appreciated. One of them was they are releasing different types of chemicals which could have very deleterious effects. Now, I'm not saying at the levels they've done so far based on our data, it's that serious yet. But if you listen to the industry itself, it's talking about doubling, tripling its operation within the next 15 years. Well, if you start doing that with the amount of contaminants already we can monitor, well, that's getting to be a much more serious problem. And of course, again, they're releasing all sorts of different chemicals. So you're dealing with this idea of multiple stressors, many things happening simultaneously. And usually those are much more negative effects when that happens.
So the bigger it becomes, the bigger the problem along with it becomes.
Yeah, and on top of that, you put on top of that climate change and all the other issues, and, you know, things start getting very complicated very quickly.
So is there no political will to do anything about it?
Well, there's not much, to put it bluntly. I mean, where the pressure's on. I think politicians are learning that, you know, there's a cost to not doing anything, including political cost, and I think we've seen that already even in the oil sands, that some infrastructure might be in trouble because people say, well, you know, you just haven't done a good enough job and we don't basically even let you go with it. So I think it has very serious issues in those respects. I mean, there could be strong economic costs coming from not doing enough either, let alone all the environmental costs. So I think some politicians are getting onto it that there are issues with what they've done, and they're going to have some negative impacts of that as well.
So how is it you're conducting your research in the Alberta oil sands? What specifically are you doing?
Yeah, well, I run a lab. There's about, you know, between Brian Cumming and myself at this lab here at Queen's University, there's about 30 of us. And what we do is we look at long-term environmental change. We look at lake sediments. I'm a lake biologist, but I specialize in looking at long-term change by the information contained in lake sediments. Sediments are kind of wonderful. They're, you know, 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, mud accumulates at the bottom of a lake. And that's like a time machine going back in time. In that mud is a history book of what happened in the lake and happened outside the lake. So we can go and we take a tube of mud or a tube of sediment. This is how I started my work at Brock back in 1977. And the deeper you go in the mud, the older it is. It's like a time machine. And now it's much more complicated than that. We have fairly sophisticated ways of getting that sediment without disturbing it. And then we can date it. You know, the deeper you go, the older it gets. But there's ways we can say that's about the 1920s or the 1850s or 2,000 years ago. And in that mud is a very rich library of information, fossils and all sorts of other things, of organisms that lived in the lake or pollution coming into the lake, and we can reconstruct past pollution and past effects. So to use the example of the oil sands, we looked at, in this paper that I was talking about, at least at Brock, working with my Environment Canada colleagues, we looked at a bunch of sediment cores near some of the main upgraders or the main facilities in the oil sands region, and we looked at one type of pollutant called PAHs, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. They're a serious pollutant. They come from both natural and human sources. The US EPA ranks them up in the top 12, and they're sort of negative health effects at high concentrations. And they're often associated with the petroleum industry. Well, there's been a lot of controversy in the oil sands. Some people, especially one might say on the industrial side, have been saying, well, yes, the pollution levels in the water near the oil sands might be higher, but it's all natural. Sounds like acid rain again. It was all natural. But the argument is made that the bitumen, that's material that they're taking out to make the oil sands material, it's almost like an asphalty tar. Well, it's tar, basically. It feels like tar sands, hence the name tar sands. That the bitumen is so close to the surface, you know, you can walk around and you see it sort of easing out of the riverbank. The reason it's higher in the water levels is because it's always been oozing out. It's natural. Well, how do you show that it isn't natural and that humans were the factor? Well, no one was measuring what the pollutants were like in the 1800s or the early 1900s, and the oil sands operation has been there since the 1960s. So we have a long history of disturbance, but no one knows what the water quality was like. So the way you can do that, you can use the time machine of lake sediments. You go back, you take sediment cores, and you analyze the pollutants that are stable. It's like a history of the pollution in the mud. You go back in time and you can show when the pollution started to increase. And sure enough, what we showed is you can start seeing an increase in these pollutants starting in the 1960s and really getting much higher over the last 20 years, coincident when the oil sands has been greatly increasing in operation. So we could show that, no, the pollution isn't natural. It actually is coming from the oil sands operations, or certainly that's what the data suggested. And so that's just one application of how you can use this historical approach. And that's one of the things that we used it for, and that's what was one of the examples I used in my talk at Brock.
That would have been a rather lame excuse for the pollution being there. Well, it was always there.
Yeah, well, you know, in acid rain, we had the same type of thing. Acid rain was when I cut my teeth on. What is one of the biggest questions you had? You know, have lakes acidified? No one could deny you could go to lakes like in Algonquin Park or Adirondack Park, and you could measure the acidity or the pH of the water, and you could say, well, some of these lakes are acid. The argument was made, especially, you know, by the companies that were producing acid rain, saying, oh, yes, it's acid now, but it's always been acid. Well, how could you prove it hasn't always been acid? Well, you had to know what the acidity was like in the 1800s. Well, before acid rain. Well, that could be a problem. Sorensen only invented pH in 1909. No one was measuring the acidity back in the 1800s. So we had to use our methods to reconstruct past acidity levels, which we did, and showed that, no, it's acid rain is coming, and it's coming from human activities. So a historical perspective is very important in all these types of analyses, I think.
Just out of curiosity, how would you physically process the information you would get from the sediment? I mean, you've got a container of mud, essentially.
That's right, yeah. Well,
what do you do?
Okay, so the first thing you have to do is remove the history book from the bottom of a lake. You know, that might be 20, 30 meters of water between you and the mud. So I use the analogy, we can take cores going back thousands of years, but for most of the work we're talking about in this interview, we're talking about the last 200 years of history. So what we only need is a short sediment core. We only need about a half a meter, about 50 centimeters. In about 50 centimeters of most Ontario lakes or most Canadian lakes, you're going to get back a couple of hundred years. So the first thing is you got to get the sediment core. What we do is and of course that sediment is very wet water. You don't want to disturb it. If you disturb it, it's like disturbing the pages in a book. You don't want to do that. So you have to enter the sediment slowly. And what we do is we lower down, basically in its simplest way, it's a little more complicated than this, but I use the analogy of, say you have a milkshake in front of you, you have a straw. You slowly lower your straw into your milkshake, and then you put your thumb on top of the straw and you pull it out. You took a core of your milkshake. Well, more or less, that's kind of how we're doing it. We lower on this rope a core, what we call a sediment core, and it's much like a straw with your thumb off the top, and it's the weight of the core slowly goes into the mud because it's very wet. When you're at the depth you want, you send down what we call a messenger, which is a lead weight on the rope, and it's like putting your thumb on top of the straw. Then you pull it out, and then you bring it to the surface to your boat or on your ice surface if you're doing it in winter, and there you have a core of the sediment. So that's the first step. The next step is you want to slice it going back in time, and we typically slice it, say, half a centimeter. For most lakes, slicing about half a centimeter is about 5 or so years of history. Each half centimeter is about 5 years of lake history. So the surface, you know, the top half centimeter will take you back from 2013 to 2008 or so. And we can do that going back in time. Now, I'm saying about 5 years. It changes from lake to lake. And we have independent ways of measuring that. We do different types of isotopes. Going farther back in time, people use C14 or radiocarbon dating. It's the same thing archaeologists use. Well, we use that for the old stuff. But for the more recent stuff, we have different methods. And we can say that's about 1932, or that's about 1875. And so now we have these sections of this core going back, say, 200 years, and then we look at what's in there. Some of it is fossils, microscopic organisms that lived in the lake, so we can reconstruct what lived in the lake. And that takes a lot of work on a microscope and identifying these bits and pieces of fossils. And some of it is chemical. We send stuff, for example, to Environment Canada, and it'll take the oil sands operation. They'll analyze the PAHs, or the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or they'll analyze it for DDT or for mercury. So that gives you an archive or a history of what happened in the lake in the past.
I almost liken it. I'm not sure if I'm right in assuming this correlation, but if you were to chop down a tree and you look at the rings in the stump, mm-hmm. which are going to tell you roughly the age of the tree.
Yeah, it's the same type of thing. They're both what we call natural proxies or natural archives, actually, is a better word. And ice cores is another example. They're all using the same types of methods, going back in time, but back in time is often where the answers lie hidden for many of the things we're worried about.
So I know you touched on the lack of reliable long-term monitoring data in doing the research that you and your colleagues have been doing over the while. Is it a case of records simply were not kept until more recently, or there was not the technology available to process the information?
It's a combination of factors. One is simply the technology wasn't there. pH is a good example. No one knew how to measure acidity of lakes in the 1800s, so we couldn't do it. But, you know, people didn't even know what PAHs were in the 1800s, so they couldn't do it. So a lot of it is the technology wasn't available. Another thing was we just simply didn't have the resources and the people to do it. Monitoring lakes takes a lot of effort. Going back to the lake every 2 weeks or something. We don't have the resources of the people to actually do that. A third factor is maybe me being my more cynical environmental self, people didn't want to know the answers, because I would probably get arguments there, but for some areas, I think people just out of mind, if you don't know about it, it doesn't exist, it's not going to cause a problem, so why monitor your blood pressure? It might give you bad news,
We don't want the bad news.
We don't want the bad news, so just don't monitor it.
Which leads me to my last question. Are we learning from our mistakes, do you think?
I think to some extent we are. History teaches us of what worked and what didn't work in what we did. So I think there are some positive signs. I think acid rain was a relatively positive sign. But I think we're slowly learning from our mistakes, but not very fast. And some of the things we have to learn is that, if anything, we've been overly optimistic about environmental issues. You look at the history of environmental issues, even people like me have been overly optimistic. When I identified a problem, people say, oh, you're just causing all sorts of trouble. Well, if I look back, I was being overly optimistic. So I think that's a major lesson we're also learning. And unintended consequences. History shows us there's all these unintended consequences in what we do. So I think history teaches us all those lessons. So I think we're slowly learning, but we're not learning very fast.
Yeah, it's a bit of a domino effect, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah. As soon as you got one problem, another problem starts, and the problems just accentuate.
Now, just out of curiosity, as we ramp things up, what do you see personally or yourself as the worst environmental situation we're facing today?
I think the worst thing is climate change, or human-induced climate change, because it's causing all sorts of other problems. The longer we wait, the harder it is to deal with, and it's a complex problem.
Are you pessimistic or optimistic?
The fact I still rage means I still think there's hope, but we are very, very late to start taking action. We should have been doing much more for a much longer period of time, and it's not going to get any easier the longer we delay.
John, thank you very much for your time today. It's a fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Dr. John Small, a Brock Master of Science graduate in biology from 1979. He's now Canada Research Chair, Environmental Change at Queen's University. He was back at Brock last week to receive the 2013 Distinguished Mathematics and Science Alumni Award and to give a lecture. We've covered some weighty subjects over the past few months on Inquisitive Minds, from cancer research to water quality and environmental disasters in the making up north. But for a little while here, let's let the proverbial hair down a bit. We'll kick off our sensible shoes and talk about something entirely different on the show. Recently, while preparing for another interview in the studio, I was introduced to an instructor at Brock's Center for Studies in Arts and Culture, Marley Centaur. Marley is both a freelance writer and cultural historian, whose main interests include the intersections between visual culture, popular music, fashion, cinema, and youth culture. She has taught in the Department of Visual Arts and Studies and in Arts and Culture since 2010, with a variety of courses ranging from writing in the arts to visual culture, Canadian art history, and media transformations in the creative arts. A lot of the research Marley does focuses more specifically on popular music and youth culture, specifically the counterculture of the 1960s and all that came with it. Marley will be heading to France in April to present at a conference on love and rock music. Her recent publications include a paper on Mick Jagger and his role in the film Performance. Marley Centaur joined us in our CFPU FM studios recently to talk about popular culture and the Beatles. And I asked how all this began for her. Is it really part of her DNA?
Wow, that's a great question. I think it is in my genetic makeup, for sure. From a very young age, I was fascinated with music. And I think that love of music came from my grandmother. So from a very young age, she would play records with those old credenza-type record turntables in her living room. And I remember my first musical experience was listening to Chicago's If You Leave Me Now. So whenever I hear that song, it brings back lots of nostalgia and memories of childhood for me. And then growing up, it was the 80s, and I remember seeing lots of music videos on TV at a very young age and was really fascinated how they were these promotional, sort of performance-based music videos. So it was a whole new kind of medium for me, but also for music in general, with MTV starting up in the early 80s. And then became very fascinated with kind of alternative music, kind of in my adolescence, listening to a lot of Canadian radio stations. Radio really fed me my music at that time. This is before YouTube, before those kind of mediums that came out. So radio has been a love of mine for quite a while, and my life kind of changed significantly in 1995 when I tuned in to this broadcast of a documentary about music, and it turned out to be the Beatles anthology that was screened on, I think it was ABC or CTV in Canada, and I just became transfixed because immediately I was seeing the arts, culture, creative arts channeled through, you know, these four lads from Liverpool, and they kind of became a touchstone for me with my music fandom, but also my academic studies, which I started to explore popular music studies years later in university. So really, the Beatles were a significant impact on my life because they showed me so many different parts of life. They showed me visual arts, fashion, music, culture, youth culture, film, pretty much endless. You could look at the Beatles from all those different viewpoints.
So is that where basically the cultural historian aspect comes into play? You're looking at the music, you're looking at the effect the music and the musicians who made it had on us over that period of time?
Absolutely. And looking at how music is situated within the culture in which it's produced and the effects that it has on the culture, but also the effects the culture has on the music. And the Beatles were a great introduction for me to look at music in that way, and also to look more at the 1960s in particular in relation to youth culture and how all these different elements of the creative arts were coming into being through this new youth culture that kind of rose to prominence in the post-war period in America and also in England.
The 1960s, social change was all around us.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time of great upheaval, and there was a feeling of change afoot. But do you think we learned anything from that period of time when so much was going on, so much change was happening? Did we learn anything?
It's a great question. I think we definitely learn something because it caused so many reverberations in the culture then as well as now. And even the fact that we're studying this era and all the social change and activity that was happening speaks volumes to how powerful it really was. And even in my own life and experience, I've kind of witnessed the ramifications of all that 60s energy and idealism, and it still exists today. I spent some time last year out west doing a volunteer program on Cortez Island and living there as well, and there's a lot of that 60s energy still alive and well and creating change. So it's definitely out there. The 60s kind of planted seeds, and while we may not have as much of that vibrancy back then or that hopefulness, I think it's been planted in the culture, and it's kind of what we do with it now and kind of apply it to our everyday lives now.
Now let's talk about the Beatles, because inextricably linked to the 1960s was the rise of the Beatles. I'm going to mention this up front. I've had a love-hate relationship with the Beatles from the very beginning, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment. I remember my first memory of the Beatles. You'll laugh at this. 1963, and I was just a little kid. I was probably still in short pants, and I was riding my bike in my neighborhood, and I had a little transistor radio strapped to my handlebar. And I remember listening to She Loves You, blaring out of this tiny little speaker. It sounded terrible, but that's what we did back then. And that was, I recall now, my first exposure to the Beatles and this new sound.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first exposure to the Beatles?
Well, my first, that's a beautiful story, by the way. And I've met people, and part of my research is talking to people who came of age with the Beatles and experienced them. So, you know, hearing about people's first exposure to the Beatles was the Ed Sullivan appearance in 1963. Like, phenomenal. And people say, you know, time stopped. Everybody gathered in their living rooms communally to watch this. And I think there's even a fact they said there was, like, no reported crime in the U.S. when that happened. So that's pretty fascinating. But for me, like I mentioned earlier, my introduction to the Beatles, apart from maybe hearing a song here and there on the radio, was the Beatles Anthology. And that's a project that the Beatles company, Apple, was kind of resurrected. And Apple started in the late 60s. The Beatles started Apple, which was their own recording company, and after the death of their manager, Brian Epstein. And then it was kind of shifted over time. And then in the 90s, they put together this documentary that had been started in the late 60s called The Long and Winding Road, and it was going to be the definitive tell-all of the Beatles history by the Beatles. The Beatles anthology that was screened in 1995, it was November. It was done over a series of 3 nights, and I'm so thankful that my dad at the time taped it with a VHS, so I was able to see it. And it happened around the time of my birthday, because I was born in late November, and like I said, I was just transfixed. And then to coincide with the documentary, the Beatles anthology was also released as 3 sets of double CDs, and this featured all sort of, you know, unknown, rare demo tracks from the band that had never been officially released before. And then in addition to that, the 3 remaining Beatles, so Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr, reconvened to record a series of new tracks, and I put air quotes around that, new tracks, with the late John Lennon. So the estate of John Lennon and Yoko Ono gave the remaining Beatles permission to rework these demos that John Lennon had recorded. And what came forth were the new Beatles singles called Free as a Bird and Real Love. And those were produced by Jeff Lynne from Electric Light Orchestra. They have a very sort of traditional or trademark Beatles sound. So those were fascinating as well. And it kind of caused, I remember this, it caused all this resurgence in Beatle, kind of a new Beatlemania or Beatle fandom. And it was kind of my first introduction to, you know, record stores and CD stores. And I remember going in and seeing all this new Beatles memorabilia, all these re-released vinyl albums and calendars and T-shirts. So it kind of spawned this whole new generation of Beatle fans and reworked their image for a new audience, which was really fascinating to experience myself, kind of this next generation of Beatle fans, all lined back to this Beatles anthology project. And then, of course, I became obsessed, as one does in their early teens. I think it was Alan Cross. He's a DJ in Toronto. I learned a lot about music history from listening to his show, The Ongoing History of New Music. And he said once that teenagers are able to dedicate the most amount of time and disposable income to their fandom because they have the most amount of time and disposable income. They're not paying rent or whatever. So they're able to cultivate this incredible sense of fandom and dedication to music. And that's what happened to me. And fortunately, it's stuck with me up to my current age. So.
And you're able to make part of your career out of it, which is even better.
Yeah, and that's been very rewarding. The fact that I came to realize through my university career, wow, I can actually study these things that I'm so passionate about and so fascinated with. Because before that, it was just a fandom I kind of dedicated on my own, you know, listening to music, reading books, reading biographies, autobiographies about not only the Beatles, but music that was from the same era. And to get to university, and it's like, wow, you know, there's actual courses. I can study music and popular culture and popular music and youth studies. And it's been very rewarding for me as a fan, but also an academic.
Now, here's the problem I've got with the Beatles, and it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're 40 or 50 years ago, which is in itself hard to believe. 50 years ago, half a century ago, the Beatles were breaking out onto the charts, and people still venerate them to this day. How influential are they today? In their day, they were very much so influential. But has that carried on into this generation?
That's another really important question I think we need to ask about the Beatles and their kind of contemporary fandom. And it's something I hope to look at in a future project of mine, especially looking at how the Beatles have kind of resonated and landed with Canadian audiences, not only in the 60s, but also in our contemporary era. Like I said, the anthology project really created this new wave of Beatlemania. And I mean, you can even look to the fact that the Beatles are being studied in their own master's programs, Liverpool Hope University. They have an entire master's program dedicated to studying the Beatles, popular music, and society. And if I hadn't have already completed my master's work, I definitely would have done that because it looks at the Beatles' relevancy then as well as now. And looking at how the Beatles cultivated, you know, a sense of place and space in their music coming from Liverpool, how they resonated there with their music and influence with fashion, lifestyle even as well. And then also in London, and they were part of this cultural epicenter in the swinging London kind of era in the mid to late 60s. So you had the Beatles moving from Liverpool to London to kind of establish themselves, and they opened up Apple Records as well. And so they definitely created a lot of trends and lasting changes within the music industry, the recording studio especially, and also even up till today, the way that popular music is recorded. And that was through their relationship working with George Martin, their producer at EMI Studios in St. John's Wood in London. And that was a relationship that was so pivotal to their sound, because it could be argued that the Beatles wouldn't be what they are today or were today if it wasn't for the technological finesse of George Martin in the studio. The Beatles' relevancy today, even at Brock University, myself, I teach in for the Center for Studies in Arts and Culture and also in the Department of Visual Arts. And even within some of those courses, I'm able to tie in this relevancy of the Beatles in our current era. There's one lecture I do actually for a course I teach called Media Transformations and the Creative Arts, where we spend one whole lecture looking at the shifts that have changed in the recording studio for popular music. And I look at the Beatles in comparison to, say, a newer band like Radiohead, and try to make links and connections to the kind of developments that they've had with their music, recording processes, and influence on a particular audience. So it's pretty fascinating stuff. We can link the Beatles with so many different developments.
The Beatles' music, even today, mm-hmm. is re-recorded, reimagined, if you will. So it's part of our modern world as well. But is it relevant to the current generation because of that? We are still not so much listening to the original recordings. A lot of people are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it is being re-recorded by today's artists and reinterpreted, does that make it more relevant to today's generation, do you think?
Well, I think for me, as a strong fan of the Beatles, sometimes I do, as a fan, sometimes I'm concerned that these original works are being interpreted and reworked. For example, I haven't seen Across the Universe, which is that film that came out a few years ago that uses the Beatles music, but recorded by different artists. And it's not that I'm not open to that, it's just I feel so strongly about those original works. But at the same time, I think because the Beatles' message was timeless in a sense, it's very optimistic, there's a lot of peace, love, of we can work it out, all these beautiful messages being planted in the songs that really do carry over to today. And I think it is important that the message is being kind of moved forward by new artists who are reinterpreting and reworking their songs.
Okay, now conversely, the tribute bands that come out,
yeah,
and specifically the Beatles, I'm not quite sure how I accept them. Mm-hmm. Some love that, and others, like myself, maybe not so much. Does it help the cause, do you think? The fact that they are willing to allow us to live in the past and not progress. We want to reimagine what 1963 looked and sounded like, but we're not allowing ourselves to let go of that.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating thing to look at. You know, I'm thinking back to myself experiencing Beatle tributes. I think years ago, I probably was maybe 18, I saw the Caverners, who are local. I'm not sure where they're based, but they're local to the Niagara region. And they do that, you know, you're taken back to 1963, 64 with the mop tops, the traditional look of the Beatles, or one of the looks of the Beatles. You know, they've got the suits. And again, it's sharing the music, but at the same time, you know, we have to question the authenticity. It really is this kind of subjective interaction that the audience or the listener has with what they're seeing or listening to. And, you know, if they prefer those original recordings or concert footage, they'll go to that. But if they want to enjoy the Beatles in a different kind of vein or perspective, they might want to go see the Caverners and just have fun and not get too serious about it, you know, not studying it for hours, writing essays about it. But, you know, it's funny. Part of my research, I guess, as a cultural historian, I'm fascinated with cultural tourism, which is really just going to these places and spaces that become famous through music and, say, youth culture for my purposes. And spring of 2010, I had the opportunity to go to Liverpool, birthplace of the Beatles. And it was fascinating for me to see how the Beatles have been paid tribute in their home city. So just a few years ago, they established a Beatles museum on the waterfront, which I actually didn't get a chance to go to because I was more fascinated in the actual childhood homes of the Beatles. So there's tours that you can take. It's a magical mystery tour. You actually get on the bus and it's painted as the Magical Mystery Tour, which was the Beatles 1967 film that they produced. So I got to see where they grew up. I also got to see the Cavern Club, which is a very important Beatles landmark. It's in Matthew Street downtown, and that's where the Beatles played almost 300 shows between 1961 and 1963. So they really cultivated their sound there, as well as in Hamburg a few years earlier, where they went and played probably the same amount of shows for 12-hour sets each night. On one hand, I was very impressed because even John Lennon's home has been bought by the National Trust and it's preserved as a significant cultural and historical landmark. But then you get these kind of maybe kitschy or tacky memorabilia shops where the memorabilia is not that it has to be sanctioned by the official Apple company, but in some ways it cheapens this kind of image of the Beatles that maybe some people have or some people don't. So it's a bit of a slippery slope, this idea of paying tribute. I think it really lies with the kind of subjective experience of the listener or the audience and what they're interested in terms of their fandom.
That was Marley Sintewer, an instructor in the Department of Visual Arts and Studies in Arts and Culture at Brock, and a learned advocate of the Beatles. She'll be back on a future edition of Inquisitive Minds with more on that subject, and very soon she'll be hosting her own program, Saturday afternoons, here on CFBU-FM. If you live like we do in a so-called university town, you see a lot of benefits coming from the relationship, be they economic, cultural, and so on. But being a university town sometimes presents problems, too. Off-campus behavior, for example, or the need for adequate and safe housing within the community. These issues and more have been addressed in a new book entitled Town and Gown, From Conflict to Cooperation, authored by Michael Fox and published by Municipal World Books. Michael Fox is a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick, and a member of the International Town and Gown Association, as well as the Town and Gown Association of Ontario. We caught up with Professor Fox at his home in New Brunswick on the weekend, and I asked him about the Town and Gown Association.
Well, the Town and Gown Association, there's actually one close to home, certainly close to Brock, and that's the Town and Gown Association of Ontario. And they've developed over about the last 10 years, but they've really been going for the last 20, 25 years, essentially to address the issues and opportunities that having a university in your community can present. And by and large, I think it's fair to say most of the time it's been negative, so some sort of orientation week issue, student parties get out of hand, police called in, those sorts of things. It just was a series of universities and communities across Ontario that started to have these issues. They also had some student housing issues back in the day, and of course still today with rooming houses and too many people in too small a building, those sorts of civic issues that cities and residents used to complain about, and universities over the years have tried to house students on campus but have simply lost out on that, maybe getting students for the most part in first year, but moving off campus. So it's that whole churn of having a university in residential neighborhoods and the mix of longtime residents and younger 18 to 24-year-olds primarily in the community. And, of course, what has happened over the 10 years of this professional association is that we've gotten, I think, better and better at looking at our best practices, our common challenges, doing some research that communities can benefit from. So it's really grown. And then at the same time, over the last 10 years, the International Town and Gown Association, you know, what's happening in Ontario is happening across Canada, across North America, and around the world. There are, of course, thousands of universities that have been around for hundreds of years. And yet it's something that's been really sort of under-researched. And so it has been this last decade where we've seen, certainly in Ontario and Canada, that's been the dominant area, but across Canada and around the world now. So the Ontario group have really been pioneers, Kay Crawford, and in fact, in the early days, some people from Brock were very instrumental in starting the Town and Gown Association.
So there is an international and there's an Ontario. Are there associations, Town and Gown Associations, throughout the country or throughout North America?
Not really, no. It's been an interesting sort of here and there. Many, many communities have their own sort of local civic university town and gown committee. Very often it arises when there is a problem where the university president is called to account for the behavior of the students at the university. It's always a situation that is full of tension. Certainly Queens has endured this over the years with their homecoming. Western has had some issues around St. Patrick's Day, these sort of student rituals, perhaps, that we might call them, where sometimes it gets out of hand. And, of course, they're not always students. Local residents and young people. Queens had 6,000 and 8,000 and 10,000 people coming from far and wide to attend their homecoming parties. And this is where we ended up having the riot police called in and significant amounts of security, ultimately canceling their homecoming. And they just reinstated it again this year. And they had 3,000 or 4,000 people back again. So every town has its issues. Of course, the bigger the community, you know, the Torontos and the Montreals and even the St. Catharines of the world, where you would have probably maybe 15% of the population in this sort of student university college age range. So the smaller the community, a place like Sackville, where I am here in New Brunswick, we have 30% of the population is student, and 5,000 local residents and 2,800 students. So it's a different sort of college town environment. But no matter where we are, having a university in the community has all sorts of benefits, but primarily civic leaders have had to deal with problems confronting student service and student government professionals, that sort of thing. But Ontario, I think because of the sort of the dominant Ontario college system, where we still have a fairly large percentage of university and college budgets coming directly from the province, I think that's been a more consistent approach. Certainly the town and gown organizations in Ontario are really ahead of the game on that.
How would you handle a problem area between a community and a university? In other words, do you have any mandate to go out and perhaps act as, for want of a better expression, an ombudsman in a case like this? Or what are you able to facilitate between the two sides?
Well, I think that's a really good characterization of it. I think forward-looking communities have taken this challenge and this set of challenges to heart, and maybe a little slow coming to the table have been the universities, actually. And this is the age-old sort of university tradition, the ivory towers, the place on the hill. You know, in fact, I went to Western in London, literally a former golf course up on the hill, removed from the town. And we have throughout history the university with walls and gates and moats around it, the sort of Oxford and Cambridge model. And so universities are an entity almost unto themselves, and often forget that they're in a community and that they have a whole number of civic relationships there. So the town or city government, mayor and council, the police, the fire, they have to, and they are really have a symbiotic relationship. And when things go badly, there has to be an individual and a group of individuals that have a mandate to basically address those issues. And, of course, what my role is in the book that's just come out is that I'm trying to get civic officials to have an ongoing relationship with the university and bring both parties to the table. So having a committee is important, but one not just to deal with problems when they come along, but now looking at the economic opportunities, the investment, the role of having all of these hundreds and thousands. You know, St. Catharines has got close to 20,000 really, really bright, active, engaged people in their community. And this has got to have all sorts of positives associated with it. So I think that idea of individuals and committees and groups that are looking at this at a regular basis are going to prevent those sort of episodic problems and really concentrate on making this relationship work, especially in a place like Southern Ontario at the moment where there are so many economic challenges. A place like Brock and St. Catharines really does become a major economic engine for the community. And I think individuals from the president, the vice presidents, student government, and individual students become economic factors, economic actors in the community, as well as consumers and people who want to socialize and go to restaurants and coffee shops, pubs, etc. So there has to be a relationship there, and it starts at the top. I'm the first to say that when the mayor and the university president have that relationship, they can make things work very well. They can lead a whole number of other people. But I think student governments, police departments, recreation offices, landlords have a huge role in this. So it's more than just one person sitting in an office. I think it's a group that are really engaged in looking at making the relationship stronger.
Would it be safe to say that rowdy behavior off campus is really one of the hot button issues in a case like this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've always been amazed that we haven't done a better job of planning this. I mean, it's like the seasons, isn't it? I mean, you know, everyone knows come September, several hundreds or thousands of young 18 to 24-year-olds will be arriving in the community, moving away from home, many of them for the first time, experiencing that freedom, and also upper-year students returning to help teach that liberation and freedom. And those students have now moved off campus and are living in higher densities, close to campus perhaps. So parties, socialization, these are absolutely some of the big hot button issues of a community. So residents often come to dread having the return to school, and that's a real shame. Simple things like having students go next door and meet their neighbors and introduce themselves, and likewise having residents go over and tell them what their expectations are, maybe bring them some muffins along the way, or say if you're having a party, you know, make sure you invite us to the party. Those sort of simple things are really the start of a good relationship, like in any neighborhood, where, you know, rather than vilify all students or paint them with the same brush, that they're all noisy and they're going to park on the lawn and urinate on my flowers and have rowdy parties. This us and them attitude really is a sort of rite of passage of those first weeks. And then, of course, then there's the end of year when over a 1 or 2 week period, those thousands of students leave the community and often leave a lot of their garbage and furniture and other things behind. Couches end up on the front lawn, sometimes on fire. So these are the literally hot-button issues that communities, unfortunately, sometimes end up dwelling on, rather than the benefit of having those students in the community.
I was chuckling to myself when you were giving that last description, because that is the picture that we all see in St. Catharines come April. A lot of abandoned couches of various descriptions on boulevards all over the city, and you can't get away from that. I don't know if you could come up with like a code of conduct, if you will, for university students and the neighbors, the rest of the community, so that they can get along with each other. But there must be some basic things that both sides can do, as you suggest, getting to know each other first off, so that you could nip a lot of these conflicts in the bud before they become overblown.
Oh, yes, exactly. I think I'm not sure if it's still going on in St. Catharines, but Brock Student Union used to do, I think they called it Community Connections, where they did work with students and say, you know, if you're moving off campus, these are the basic rules of behavior. Also helping them in an ombuds-like way with housing issues. You know, if you move into an apartment, there are housing regulations, and Ontario's got some very clear rules there in terms of leases. And so, you know, you have to have a functioning toilet, and your landlord has to repair things, and you have to have certain standards of appliances, and, you know, the big one, of course, smoke detectors. I'd be willing to predict, you know, if you walked into half of the off-campus housing units in St. Catharines, they probably don't have a functioning smoke detector. So, you know, there's some really serious ground rules that communities can work with universities and student governments to set these. I think what you're right, a code of conduct is a good way of phrasing that. And that's certainly where then your planning department, bylaw enforcement officers, police, campus security, they can all work together in making sure that, you know, not that you're looking at enforcement as the single only option, but certainly if everyone's playing by the same rules, that's really helpful. And many campuses, many universities are building this into their orientation activities. It's often, again, not those first year students, because they're to a large degree living in residence, and we know that there are all sorts of rules there. It's when they move off campus, behavior and the behavior of landlords sometimes becomes a little questionable. Having the internet, of course, has been really helpful. So we've got Rate Your Landlord Landlords now, those options. If landlords are going to be unscrupulous, they might end up on a do not rent list, you know, those sorts of things. And I think town governments, city governments are really seeing this as an opportunity where students, their ability to care about the community, the volunteerism in university communities is phenomenal. I mean, it's just incredible what university students are willing and interested to do. This notion of community engagement activities now across North America has really been helpful to these communities. So I think a code of conduct and also a strategy to maybe have some of these students remain in the community. So it's always, again, been interesting to me that students are seen as being sort of short-term and fleeting and not really offering anything to the community. But my goodness, the relationship, that symbiotic relationship between the university, the life of the downtown, right where your radio station is, if you're in the downtown and there are students all around you, they're going to be close to and need to shop and to have coffee shops and bookstores, and they're certainly going to consume and volunteer in the community as well. I mean, that's the essence of sort of the community engagement side of planning. So I think there's all sorts of opportunity there that when you have that sort of relationship, that poor behavior certainly goes down.
And you have to have the cooperation of all parties, the student union, the students themselves, the community, and the municipal government. They basically all have to be on the same page and say, here are the problems, here's what we're going to do about it.
Yes, that's right. I've, again, been trying to point out the various communities I work with. You know, in most places, we often think of the city as the sort of the big partner there. But when you think of it, you know, if you just a quick look at Brock and the city's website, say, you know, Brock's got an annual budget of $300 million, whereas the city of St. Catharines budget is just over $100 million. So the university is actually a significant, a phenomenal economic partner. No community you would want sort of one of the biggest, if we can call a university an industry, but certainly biggest economic engine in the community, you certainly wouldn't want to be at odds with them. You'd want to work very carefully in terms of economic growth and development. And I know that certainly Brock and past presidents and student governments as well have worked with the city of St. Catharines. I'm not suggesting that they don't, but you always have to be aware of that. I mean, just think of the 1,500 faculty and staff at Brock. That's a huge employment opportunity. And, almost 90% of the students at Brock live in the community. So it's an absolute for the civic government, as far as I'm concerned.
It's funny that you mentioned that, the size of Brock and the population.
Yeah.
What people maybe don't always realize is the fact that someone mentioned to me in the fall, and even I hadn't realized it until they mentioned it, Brock is essentially one of the largest employers in the city.
It is indeed, yes. Even the entire Niagara region, I mean, it is the educational institution. Certainly the colleges are important as well, but in terms of, you look at the research now that's going on at Brock and any other community, you know, as Richard Florida to University of Toronto suggests, this notion of a creative community is now really has replaced, sort of the manufacturing industries of cities of the past. It's this creative group, the research potential, the economic impact of having that $300 million, I'm sure at least half of it is coming from those very students, undergraduate and graduate students that are coming to learn and live in the community. So, you know, anywhere else, I guess for a long time, we've always used the sort of what's good for General Motors is good for Detroit model. That's probably not a good example anymore, and just shows us how, look at Detroit now without General Motors and their bankruptcy. So what would St. Catharines and the Niagara region be without Brock University? That's not to suggest that the university doesn't have a responsibility to be the best of partners here. And when you're dealing with humans, young people, researchers, highly paid, highly educated faculty and staff, it's a really dynamic and fragile relationship, that's for sure. You really do need to give a lot of attention to that. And if you don't, you know, like any relationship, then it gets tired and problems start to happen and you need intervention and counseling. The analogies come quickly here.
And I do want to mention the fact that not every student at Brock University is presenting problems any more than at any other university. It's usually a small group that give the university population as a whole a bit of a bad name. And therein lies the problem. It's not everybody who's causing the problem.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But, you know, the media, and I don't want to paint you again and others with a broad brush, but, you know, the media certainly has a role in this. If it's something sensational like a massive house party where there are police interventions and the fire department is called and the neighbors have called the newspaper and written to the editor, this is what takes in a significant amount of attention and is played in the media. The students that go to the local elementary and secondary schools and coach basketball and working with their local churches and cleaning up the streams and rivers and lakeshore, they don't always get noticed, and that's part of a community as well. But the sort of sensational hot button issues that we mentioned earlier sometimes dominate people's consciousness and people get stereotyped. And, you know, students like any other population group sometimes get stereotyped. Student housing, for example, is something that irks me, because use any other descriptor than student and you're into some human rights issues. So you don't classify and have land uses according to what people actually do there. And so students often get demonized because of the actions of a few, that's for sure.
The book is called Town and Gown, From Conflict to Cooperation, and it's available now from municipalworld.com. And our guest has been Michael Fox, who is a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick. Thank you very much for your time today.